Ukraine is getting a new defense minister.
Zelensky made the announcement on his official Telegram account, writing that new leadership was needed after Reznikov went through more than 550 days of full-scale war.
Plus, Poland is to bolster its national defenses.
The war in Ukraine showed us that the similar forces in Ukraine played a very big role. So why not just maybe get into a little bit of into army life ourselves?
And later in the program, grain deal talks take place in Sochi, and we bring you a conversation with Amnesty International about what's going on now that the new school year has begun in Russia and Russian-occupied Ukraine. Today is Monday, September 4th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We take a look at how Poland plans to bolster its national defense after Russia's aggression towards Ukraine, coming up shortly. We begin, though, with an update to a story Anna Chernikova told us about last week. The rumors she told us about are official now. Ukraine will get a new defense minister. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov will be replaced this week with Rustem Umerov. He's a Crimean Tatar lawmaker and head of Ukraine's main privatization fund. Charles de Ledesma has our first report.
Zelensky made the announcement on his official Telegram account, writing that new leadership was needed after Reznikov went through more than 550 days of full-scale war. Zelensky says he believes that the ministry needs new approaches and different formats of interaction, both with the military and with society. The 41-year-old Umerov is from the opposition Holos Party and has served as head of the State Property Fund of Ukraine since September 2022. Zelensky's announcement comes after two people were hospitalized following a 3.5-hour Russian drone barrage on a port in Ukraine's Odessa region on Sunday. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And we'll hear more about Rustem Umerov from Anna Chernikova a little later in the show. On Monday, Russian President Vladimir Putin welcomed Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan for talks in Sochi, saying they would discuss the situation in Ukraine and that Russia was open to talks on the Black Sea grain deal, which Moscow abandoned in July. Vladimir Putin speaking before the meeting.
We also have something to talk about from the point of view of ensuring security in the region. Of course, we will not ignore issues related to the Ukrainian crisis. I know that you intend to raise the issue of the grain deal. We are open to negotiations on this issue.
For his part, Erdogan, who is one of the original architects of the deal, said that the Ukraine grain export corridor was one of the most important issues in the talks with Putin. Following the meeting, however, Putin said that Russia will not renew the deal until Russia's demands are met, adding that once the demands were met, the deal could be revived in days. Putin also said that Russia is proceeding with its previously announced plan to give free grain to six African nations affected by food shortages. From the Black Sea, we go to the Baltic Sea, where Poland plans to double its armed forces to 300,000 by 2035. This with a combination of professional soldiers and volunteers. As Lesa Bakalets reports, Russia's full-scale invasion of neighboring Ukraine has prompted a large number of Poles from all walks of life to sign up as volunteers.
Jedynka gotów, dwójka naprzód! Idę!
Professors, media workers, businessmen, and students, people of various backgrounds volunteer to join the Polish Territorial Defense Forces. It's the fifth and youngest branch of the armed forces of Poland. Since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, interest has skyrocketed.
The war in Ukraine showed us that the similar forces in Ukraine played a very big role. So why not just maybe get into a little bit of into army life ourselves?
Lieutenant Colonel Grzegorz Podolszanski, deputy commander of the 5th Mazovian Territorial Defense Brigade, says his brigade's demand for training has increased.
Planowaliśmy w tym roku za w We planned to recruit and train 800 soldiers this year, but by June, when 200 volunteers were waiting outside our walls, and at the same time, knowing what is happening on the other side of the eastern border, we increased the number of soldiers in training by 200, and our goal is to reach 1,100 trained soldiers this year.
The main requirements to join the territorial defense are to be at least 18 years old and have Polish citizenship. Sebastian Nikityuk is 19, so he decided to spend part of his summer in training.
I'm on vacation now. I have one more year to study at school. And then when I graduate, I plan to become a professional soldier, studying cybersecurity.
Nikityuk is among 80 recruits who are taking a complex final exam after 16 days of basic training for the 5th Mazovian Territorial Defense Brigade. The test consists of 9 parts, from shooting and first aid to tactical exercises. Another recruit, truck driver Kamil Stalkovsky, is confident he'll pass all of them.
Physically, this training is hard, especially if someone is not in shape. But in spite of being 35 years old, I can handle it well.
None of the recruits have to quit their job. Territorial Defense Service allows people to combine their civilian and military lives. A soldier has a choice to become a full-time soldier or have part-time employment.
Every single month, for one weekend, for 2 days, they are obliged to come to the unit and do their training. But for the rest of the time, they can basically live their civilian lives as they wish. And we always have to be ready to do whatever we are summoned to do.
Kravchuk Mayran serves this way. She has combined her army duties with her work in television for the last 4 years. She says joining the Territorial Defense Forces was her best decision, considering the current situation on the Polish-Belarusian border and the war in Ukraine.
I feel ready. I feel prepared. I have a background, a military background that makes me feel more secure. It's important for me to feel that I can deal with the situation that is happening right now.
Currently, 37,000 soldiers are serving here. 90% of them are part-time. Officials say their goal is to increase that number to 50,000 in the next several years. Overall, Poland plans to double its armed forces to 300,000 by the year 2035. Lesia Bakalets for VOA News.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. Ukraine is to get a new defense minister, plus a look at Ukrainian advances on the front lines. For all the latest, I'm joined by Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
So as we discussed last week, Oleksiy Reznikov has resigned, and now Ukraine will have a new minister of defense. This new minister of defense will be Rustem Umerov. Currently, Rustem Umerov is the head of the State Property Fund of Ukraine. And what's interesting about him is that he has Tatarian Crimea origin. He used to be in different positions within the Ukrainian political circles. And what is also important to mention, that he was a member of the negotiation team at the beginning of full-scale invasion, and he basically was holding some key negotiations with Russia. So this is probably also one of the reasons why he will be appointed as a new Minister of Defense.
Okay, so a bunch to unpack here. The first question is, you mentioned he has experience negotiating with the Russians. In Kyiv, is this move by Zelensky seen as the possibility that he's open to negotiating with the Russians now?
Again, if we analyze the latest speech by President Zelensky, when he announced that he will be replacing Oleksiy Reznikov, he mentioned that the Ministry of Defense of Ukraine need new ways of management, basically, and more actions. So I guess President Zelensky expects Mr. Umerov to be the person able to to provide this kind of things.
Now, these scandals that embroiled Reznikov, those are months old. And it would seem to me, anyhow, that if Zelensky was going to fire Reznikov solely because of those scandals, it would have happened months ago. Is there anything else to indicate that perhaps Zelensky was dissatisfied with Reznikov's performance, with the military's progress in the counteroffensive? Anything else going on that might have led to Reznikov's replacement now instead of months ago?
If we look in general at this more than 550 days of war that Reznikov was a minister during full-scale invasion, we can see that President Zelensky had certain tasks appointed to every minister, and especially to the Minister of Defense. It was mostly about equipment and new equipment negotiations with the allies, and Reznikov had certain success and certain we can say victories in this particular tasks. It might be that not everything was accomplished, and this could also be the reason. But again, according to the latest speech by President Zelensky and his announcement of change in the leadership of the Ministry of Defense, he mentioned that he is he is looking for new ways of management of this ministry, and more intensive actions and more visible actions, if we can put it so.
And how significant is it that Umarov is of a different political party than Zelensky?
Yeah, this is very interesting fact as well, because he is representative of Holos. This is for Ukrainian society, and I guess for the allies as well, this is a good sign, because President Zelensky very often is accused that he appoint only people from his party, especially at such positions where president's quota is in action. So I think that this would be a positive, and this is a positive sign, both for President Zelensky's reputation at this point, and in general for the country, because Ukrainians, a lot of Ukrainians are quite concerned that the power, the governmental power, is concentrated in one hand, meaning that concentrated in one party, in the hands of one party of President Zelensky. So I think that this should be a win-win both for President Zelensky and for Ukraine at this moment of war.
And leaving the politics aside, we have a little bit of time left. Can you tell us about any military updates that this new defense minister will soon be in charge of?
Ukrainian armed forces had success in the Zaporizhia region and in the area of Bakhmut, and this was also both confirmed by the Ministry of Defense and by the Institute for the Study of War, and Ukrainian forces continue advance there. Also, it was official statement by the head of Ukrainian defense in the Zaporizhia region that Ukrainian forces managed to go first line of defense, which is the strongest line of defense of the Russian forces, which is extremely positive and positive news over the weekend for Ukraine, this is quite a success for the Ukrainian armed forces, especially considering that there were acquisitions that Ukrainian forces are moving slow. So this is one of the first such, you know, big announcement from the Ukrainian officials. Again, it was another shelling of the Odessa region this time, Odessa and Odessa region over the night. Unfortunately, there are victims, and unfortunately, Russian forces this time were targeting the ports, the seaports of the region.
And we'll leave it there for today. Anna Chernikova is in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
Following up on a story from a few months ago, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said on Sunday that an independent inquiry has found no evidence that a Russian ship had collected weapons from the country late last year and headed for Russia. Reuters' Ryan Brooks has that story.
An independent inquiry has found no evidence that South Africa supplied weapons to Russia, President Cyril Ramaphosa said on Sunday, in response to U.S. allegations that a Russian ship had collected weapons from the country late last year, which Ramaphosa said had a damaging effect on South Africa's economy and reputation.
From its investigation, the panel found no evidence that any cargo of weapons was loaded for export onto the ship Lady R. The panel found that there was no evidence to support the claim that the ship transported weapons from South Africa destined for Russia. And none of the persons who made these allegations could provide any evidence to support the claims that had been leveled against our country.
In claims that sparked diplomatic friction, the U.S. ambassador to South Africa, Ruben Brigady, said in May that the Russian cargo ship Lady R had picked up weapons at a naval base near Cape Town in December. An allegation South Africa's foreign minister said Brigady had apologized unreservedly for the next day when he was summoned. However, with doubts cast over South Africa's claim of non-alignment regarding Russia's war in Ukraine and concern of possible Western sanctions, Ramaphosa ordered a judicial probe led by a retired judge. It found instead that the Russian cargo ship had a consignment of weapons from Russia to South Africa, ordered back in 2018.
Reuters' Ryan Brooks with that story for us. There has been no comment yet from U.S. officials on the South African report. And finally today, school began in Russia and Ukraine on September 1st, and Russian authorities have produced a new textbook for high school students that, among other things, justifies Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine as a legitimate act of self-defense. I speak with Denis Krivosheev, Amnesty International's Deputy Director for Eastern Europe and Central Asia.
The issue at stake is the right to education. Children in Russia, in Russian-occupied Ukraine, elsewhere, have the right to quality education. The textbook which prompted our Amnesty International's response was the history book for the more senior school students, which gives a particular narrative about recent events in Russia and Ukraine. And that narrative is full of lies. It's indoctrinating children who will have to study history by this book with direct misrepresentation of history facts. It gives a picture of the world in which Russia appears to have to started warring against Ukraine, which it doesn't call war, it calls special military operation, and it justifies its war of aggression and the crimes that have been committed on Ukrainian territory. And that is just not acceptable. It violates children's right to education. It also indoctrinates them for future, and that itself leads to further human rights violations and essentially perpetuates what Russia is doing.
So the book essentially echoes Russian propaganda about the war and about the situation that led up to it. Where in Russia will this book be found?
It's a school textbook, so essentially for all schools where children go into, I think, I believe it's 11th grade, which is the last year of secondary school. I understand history is a compulsory subject, and to study this subject, schools will have to use this textbook. The content of this textbook will be included in exams, etc., etc. So if you study in 11th form, which most children or many children do, there's no way around it. This will be the basis of your quote-unquote knowledge about recent history. But worse still, you will have to, if you're tested in an exam, you will be tested against what this book content is, and your mark and your future will depend on that.
So what can happen to somebody in one of the occupied territories if they're caught either with a Ukrainian textbook or studying from the Ukrainian curriculum?
Practically, to study from Ukrainian curriculum is difficult. I mean, basically, there are no schools left which would be allowed to follow anything other than Russian curriculum. Now, some families, some children try to follow Ukrainian schooling online. That's a dangerous process. Basically, you have to do it via the internet. Now, all the internet now is run by Russia, so it's not safe in itself. Plus, we hear of regular checks of devices such as phones, tablets, etc. And if you get caught having content on it or software which suggests that you are following, that children are studying in Ukrainian schools online, that gets families into trouble. Now, we've heard stories of reprisals in such instances, not many, but that's partly because you don't meet many people who are in those territories and unable to speak to them in safety. But also, I guess the worst cases we will not hear about, because Russia is quite cruel about those who violate its rules and sticking with Ukraine, with Ukrainian schooling, having your loyalties elsewhere is a dangerous business. Now, the way people are forced into Russian schooling are many, but the main one is this. In the occupied territories, they have lists of children and families who live there. But they try to have the same school staff teach on the Russian curriculum. Obviously, some do, others don't. If you refuse, that is a way to reprisals. But generally, Russian occupying authorities know of children who are local, and they force they insist that the family send them to what is now schools teaching Russian curriculum. And you can't really refuse. It's not that you're given a choice. If you want to remain there, that's your own option. If you want to move, that's itself a dangerous process. Not everyone is able to do it for safety reasons as well as economic and other. And there is also the forced Russian passportization. So families are forced to apply for Russian citizenship. That's the condition for staying there. Once that's happened, you have to go to Russian school, follow Russian curriculum, be loyal to Russia. Deviating from this is fraught with consequences, and they may range from just intimidation and harassment to detention, and if anything worse, then we won't even hear of such stories. Not for now.
So the textbook, it seems, is really just a small problem, just a symptom of the larger campaign against Ukrainians in these occupied territories.
That's exactly the case, yes. So Russians occupy these territories. They claim that they are now part of Russia. They demand full, total loyalty from local population. And if they don't get it, there are reprisals for that. And yes, schooling is just one element of Russia effectively converting these territories and people who live there from Ukrainians into Russians.
And what kind of work is Amnesty International able to do, either to counter this or to help the people who are there?
Well, in times of war, as you can imagine, there's very little a human rights organization can do, but at the very least we can do is learn about it and tell this story, and that's what we're doing. And again, the school, this textbook, is a small element of what Russia is doing, but all those elements need to be exposed and told about. It's just that this particular one is so outrageous that we felt it deserved a special mention. But we look into what's happening to people in occupied territories as much as we can, because research on the ground is complicated, and it's not safe to reach out to people in territories controlled by Russia. You can't have safe conversations. We try and do it. We also speak to those who make it into safety on the other side. And we learn a lot, and we tell these stories, and we're not the only ones. But it is a very cruel system that is brutal to those who don't agree to the rules they're imposing.
Denis Krivosheev is Deputy Regional Director for Eastern Europe and Central Asia for Amnesty International. Sir, thanks for your time today. Thanks for your analysis.
Thank you. Thanks.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.